All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Yvonne Brooks Show. Thank you for being here live with me on this Friday evening. It's been a while. I haven't done a live show in quite a while. So thank you all for being patient with me while I was traveling. I've been to Brazil. As some of you know, I did one show from Brazil, but then, you know, the rest of the trip, internet connection was just so lousy that there was no point in even trying. It was just bad internet all around. Something new today. I don't know if you've noticed, those of you on video, I have a new camera. So I am curious. I'm curious whether you see a difference. Is the video better? Is the video the same? Is it worse? Do we need to do something different? Do I need to change the colors? I now have a camera that we can play around with more in terms of settings. Jonathan says it looks sharper. I think it does. I mean, it's an expensive camera, so it better be better. But don't tell me it looks better just to please me. That would be bad. So, all right, Jesse says he noticed immediately. And Stefan says he sees my wrinkles. So my age is showing, and of course my white hair is sparkling more. So all is good. I've invested in a nice Sony camera, and we can play around with it. I can change the depth of field. If you want to see everything in the background kind of hazy, we can do that. If you want to see it sharp, we can do that. You know, there's the same amount of light that we always have, so I guess it must be the camera that is impacting it. So thanks for the input, and thanks for watching. Those of you listening right now, please subscribe before you forget. Go to the subscribe button. We've been putting out, even while I've been traveling, a lot of my talks on video. So what I'm trying to do is rounding up all my talks from all the various sources, all the ones on the Ayn Rand Institute website, all the ones on other people's websites. I'm going after all the video of me to put it all on one channel, all accessible to you. So please subscribe, please share, please encourage other people to subscribe. And now we have cool colors and better, sharper picture, and there's even more motivation to watch, not just listen to the Yvonne Brooks Show. So please share, subscribe, recommend to other people, and so on. And please primarily do so on YouTube. I know that some of you watch on Facebook, but my preferred medium and the one I just get better stats about progress on YouTube. Combining the stats from YouTube and Facebook is messy. So my preference is YouTube, but you know, watch on whatever platform makes you happy. The other advantage of YouTube is you can ask me questions using Super Chat, so don't forget to engage that feature. All right, today we're going to answer questions from my Patreon contributors, questions that ranked the highest based on votes that they got. Now, we're going to actually do this in two shows. I'm going to continue this tomorrow, answering these questions. So we're going to do a part one and part two. Partially because there are a lot of good questions and I want to get through a lot of them. I also have a couple of Super Chat questions from last time that the video got cut off before I actually had an opportunity to answer them. So we will answer those tomorrow as well. I just need to find them and we'll answer those tomorrow. Of course, you can continue to ask Super Chat questions. I'll try to answer them today. I'll find the others. Greg says the video is different. He thinks it's better. That's kind of a philosopher's question, answer, right? I think, let me ponder this, let me consider it. I'm kidding. All right, so before I get to the actual Patreon questions that you guys voted on, those of you who contribute to Patreon voted on, and those of you who don't contribute to Patreon, please do. It's what allowed me to buy this new cool camera that where the video is better. And at least most of you think the video is better. If we took a vote, I think that would be true. So please contribute to Patreon. But before we get to that, my largest contributor, there's one person, David, who gives more than anyone else on Patreon. And he sent a question separately. And I figure given his status, he gets preference and we go to that first. And I will do that. Then I'm going to take this quick Super Chat question because it's really quick. My answer is really quick, so I'll do that. All right. Here's the question. And it basically, he wanted me to comment on an op-ed, on at least an opening paragraph of an op-ed by F.H. Buckley in the Wall Street Journal. The op-ed was titled, "Make Free Writers Pay? Easier said than done." And this is the premise. The premise is in the first paragraph. So let me read you the first paragraph. And it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting premise. And there's actually quite a bit to say about it. And I think he's wrong in the way he analyzes it. So let's look at it. He says, the gross world product, the annual value of worldwide economic production, and this is a great statistic, was more than $80 trillion in 2017. $80 trillion gross world product. You know, it's hard to measure these things, but, you know, as numbers go, it's as good as any other in terms of economics. $80 trillion in 2017. In real terms, that's more than a threefold increase, three times what it was 40 years ago, right? The enormous wealth gain reflects the benefits of a world dominated by and profiting from an American military and economy, a world with open sea lanes and unhindered trade, with the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. That's how the Trump administration sees the world. And its military and trade policies are driven by the president's desire to monetize America's contribution to the global commons. The world is free riding on us. Let's make them pay. That's Trump administration's attitude towards this. Now, I think this is actually quite interesting. And there's a lot of truth here. But it's also quite misleading. And again, the way that he analyzes it later on in the op-ed, and he offers some ideas about how to solve this problem, and his conclusion is there is no solution to the problem. But you know, and I'm not sure he actually thinks it's a problem. I think, again, he's trying to posit this as an explanation for Trump's behavior, for some of Trump's trade and foreign policy behavior. So let's first discuss this issue of a tripling in gross world product. And this is true. The world is a much, much, much richer place today than it was 40 years ago in real terms. If you look at any of the numbers out there that reflect, that are reflective of economic growth, they're reflective of wealth, poverty has come down dramatically. Wealth has gone up dramatically. Size of the middle class globally has expanded dramatically. The number of people working, not working subsistence for themselves, but working to produce goods and services has dramatically increased by billions of people. By every measure, human well-being has expanded, wealth has expanded, and in a global scale, the world is a better place. No question about that. Now, why is that the case? Well, there are a number of reasons. And one of them is what the author says here, or what the author says the Trump administration believes. One is that the American Navy and American power, military power, has basically kept the sea lanes open for trade. And a huge amount of the $80 trillion in wealth in the world today, or the annual value, or the annual product, that's not wealth, that's annual product, is a consequence of trade. Trade is incredibly beneficial. Trade is incredibly beneficial to both parties. It is wealth creating. When I buy an iPhone, I'm better off, and Apple's better off. In that sense, you know, the wealth has increased, quality of life has increased, standard of living has increased. Trade is a massive benefit to the increase in quality and standard of life across the world, including in America. Win-win. But it's true that the United States spends disproportionately more because it has a massive military and it spends more of its income on the military than any other country in the world. And it is basically the guarantor, if you will, of trading lanes. Although I'll put an asterisk on that. And I'd say that our weakness and pathetic behavior, foreign policy-wise, has often placed this in doubt. For example, you remember the pirate off the coast of Somalia. If we really were keeping the trade lanes open, which I think we should, then we would have bombed them out of existence and made sure the trade lanes would stay open. You don't have pirates. You don't allow for pirates when you have the kind of Navy the United States has. Now, the issue of pirates has gone down because we've slowly chipped away at the pirate problem. But the primary reason pirates have gone down, as far as I know, I haven't done a lot of research here, is that the shipping company started to hire private security forces to travel with them. And, of course, the pirates don't actually want to fight. They want an easy takeover and bribe, and ransom. So it's basically enhanced security that's got rid of it. But if the U.S. had really kept the shipping lanes open and was really responsible for that, there would have never been a piracy problem, or it would have been very, very short lived. But there's no question the U.S. military has kept things moving. It's also true that we're living through the most peaceful period in human history in terms of warfare, in terms of wars between countries, particularly big wars, major wars. And this is a consequence, you could say, in the past, pre-fall of the Berlin Wall, of kind of a mutually assured destruction where there was no real interest because of nuclear weapons, no real interest in a world war because of the consequence that would lead to. But I'd say since the Berlin Wall has fallen, the sheer dominance of the United States militarily in the world, it has no competitor. It has nobody that will stand up for it. There is nobody to go to war with. The only reason Islam is a threat or the Islamic totalitarians are a threat is because we won't wipe them out because we're not willing to use our military power. But there are no wars because of the dominant position the United States is in preventing those wars or in providing its military power such that nobody is out there. Nobody wants to take us on. Nobody can take us on. Not really. The Chinese might have ambitions for one day, 20 years from now, but not for now. There's just no way. So peace, increases increases wealth, non-coercion, non-force, not blowing up stuff, not killing people, is generally a conditions that are pro-wealth creation. But I think all of that is true and all of that plays a role. It is not the dominant role. It is not the dominant reason why the world has gotten so much richer, production has grown so much over the last 40 years. The main reason, which the author doesn't really acknowledge, is freedom. The main reason is economic freedom. Now, granted, China is not exactly not exactly free, but it is economically freer than it was, and in many respects, freer than most countries in the world. In some respects, even freer than the United States. It is globally a greater respect for property rights. It is the fall of the Berlin Wall and the freeing up of all the productive energy of Eastern Europe and Russia and a shift towards more markets in those countries. It is China in 1978 pivoting away from from economic communism, still authoritarianism, but away from totalitarianism and economic authoritarianism towards a free economy. It's India in 1991 liberating its economy and freeing it up. And think of all the entrepreneurial energy, and think of all the production coming out of India. Think of all the entrepreneurs and the great educational system that India has. That is many of those entrepreneurs moved to the United States. It's the freeing up the Asian tigers 40, 50 years ago from authoritarian regimes in South Korea and Taiwan And of course, what happened in Hong Kong and Singapore, but even in places like Thailand and places like that. It's the fact that wars went away, primarily because of communism's ultimate defeat, but also because I think as people got a little wealthier, they had more to lose. And as people, I think it's ideas, again, that shape these things. So I believe the Enlightenment over the last 50 years, really over the last 100 years, because of colonialism in the past, but the remnants of colonialism, the fact that these countries were exposed to Western values, but then because of television and because of the internet, I believe that the ideas of the Enlightenment, primarily just the idea of individualism, the sanctity of the individual, not a full understanding of it, but a partial, somewhat understanding of it, the ideas have gone into the world, have gone out there, and people are demanding more freedom for themselves. And as a consequence, there's a lot more production. So production is primarily a consequence of freedom. Now, you could say that adopting freedom is a form of free riders, right? We're all free riding. I mean, it's a weird term. But we're all free riding off of the Founding Fathers. And, you know, I'd apply free riders here. We're free writing on Aristotle, we're free writing on the Scientific Revolution and Newton and everybody, we're free writing on John Locke, we're free writing on the Enlightenment, we're free writing on, you know, the founders. Now, I don't like the term free writing, right, in this context, but because free writing assumes that you don't have to do anything, that you just absorb these ideas and off you go. And granted, that is true of a lot of people. And that is why all those achievements are in distress. All those achievements are at risk because too many people are free riding off of them in the sense that they don't understand them, they don't comprehend them, they don't study them, and they don't fight for them. But I don't consider learning from somebody, particularly somebody dead, free writing, I mean, it's a bizarre term, right? Free writing, the whole concept in economics is that I benefit without paying, but who am I supposed to pay? There's nobody to pay when it comes to the ideas. So I don't believe that free writing is a legitimate concept as applied to, you know, the past, and as applies to ideas. Good ideas have spread around the world. Yeah, partially because of America, because of the example that is America. But that example didn't cost us. That example has benefited us. So it's not like they owe us anything. We gave it to them for free, and they benefited from it. Cool. But we have it for free from the founders. And we benefited enormously from living it and being the example to the rest of the world. We have benefited from that because we got to live freedom. So the number one contributor to gross world product tripling over the last 40 years is ideas. Good ideas have spread to the rest of the world. Not the best ideas, not Ayn Rand, not even the best of the Enlightenment ideas, but enough of the Enlightenment ideas to triple gross world product. Just imagine what the world would look like with objectivist ideas, or even just with the founders' ideas, or with the best Enlightenment ideas, the founders. I mean, we'd be so rich, it's hard to imagine today. So I think that's the primary cause of the expansion, and therefore I think this issue of the military spending is a relatively minor issue. But let's talk about that. Because I think Trump, this is a big motivator, and I think generally people around Trump, this is, look, we fund NATO, we fund, a fleet in the Pacific Ocean that protects South Korea and Japan and Taiwan and trade and everything. And here I think there is a case. And Ayn Rand talked about this in the 60s and 70s, particularly during the Vietnam War. Do we really have a vital interest in protecting all these countries and having treaties with all these countries that protect them? Now, we clearly have a vital interest in keeping the shipping lanes open. I mean, I don't think Donald Trump understands this, but I think anybody who understands anything about trade understands this. It's worth investing in keeping the shipping lanes open because the benefits from trade to us are massive, far exceed whatever it costs. Now, I'll get to the cost issue later because there's a real issue of how much do you spend on the military? Who gets to decide? How do you decide? So we will get to that in a little bit. About how you determine military spending. But I think the benefits from sustaining the sea lanes. I also think we could have a much smaller military than we have today if that was our goal. Should we be defending South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Germany, France, the UK? Now, I don't think so. I don't think so. And in that respect, I'm much more radical than Trump is. I think we should withdraw from NATO. We should withdraw from the treaties we have over time. I don't think you should do it all at once. I don't think it's fair. You give them a 5-year sunset or a 4-year sunset or whatever it is, an 8-year sunset. Those are technicalities. And you phase your involvement in NATO, you phase your involvement in the Pacific out. You stop spending huge amounts of money defending other countries. It's not in America's self-interest. There is no clear enemy of the United States that threatens these countries militarily. American kids should not be dying, as I've said many times, for the sake of Estonia. If Russia going into Estonia is a threat to Germany, then Germany should do something about it. I don't think it's a threat to the United States. That would be a radical foreign policy as compared to Trump's, which is, oh, I'm going to harass the Germans to contribute a little bit more to NATO. No, we just shouldn't be in NATO. Now, if there's a war, like against Islamic totalitarianism, and we want allies, I don't think we need allies, but if we want allies, then you create a coalition. You create a coalition that fights a common enemy. But I don't want the Germans fighting with the United States if the Germans don't believe that the war we are fighting is just. I don't want them fighting in that war just because they happen to be members of NATO. And you see the conflict, right? Turkey was a member of NATO but didn't join in with the war in Iraq because it didn't believe in it. But then what's the point of NATO? Isn't it joint kind of military action? We all go in together. So I'm for abandoning all those treaties. I mean, phasing them out, doing it slowly. I don't think you can do these things all at once. And dramatically reducing our military spending. Because I think the problem with our military spending is that we've got a bloated, massive bureaucracy. We spend a huge amount of money on things like building democracy. We have troops, I think, today in 120 different countries. I can't imagine why we would have troops in so many countries, maybe 5, 10, 15 key countries that where we need to hunt down terrorists. And other than that, I don't see what we need. We don't need to be in Europe. Europe can defend itself. Europe is far, far richer than Russia. The Germans and the French and the British could team up together and build a military, probably already have a military, that would defeat the Russians thoroughly. They have far better technology. So the whole thing, I think, is that is the way to deal with that. So there is a way to reduce the so-called free rider problem that we defend these countries and don't get in return, and that is to not defend those countries. Right, that's the solution. It's to focus our military on only those things that pose direct threats to the individual rights of Americans, to the life and property of American citizens. That's it. I said something about military spending because this is the challenge. In a country like ours, how do you decide how much to spend? How do you decide whether being, how big of a military is right? And, that's, you elect representatives to do that. You elect politicians to do that. And ideally, they have a right conception of individual rights, and because that right conception, they structure the military and size the military appropriately to what they, the experts, believe the military should be. Now, the beauty of not having coercive taxation, the beauty of having voluntary taxes, which is the way Ayn Rand believed, the primary way Ayn Rand believed the government would be funded, is that the only way to scale up the military in such a world would be for the politicians to convince the public to write bigger checks. And therefore, they would have to have a good argument for why it was appropriate to grow the military. And they'd have to obviously convince enough people, not everybody, that's the beauty, not everybody, but they'd have to convince enough people to write big enough checks to be able to scale up the military. So that's, you know, it's the same thing with having an all-volunteer army. As Ayn Rand pointed out, you wouldn't have had enough volunteers to go and fight in Vietnam, or it would have been a very different war. And therefore, the Vietnam War wouldn't have happened, couldn't have happened, with an all-volunteer army. And I think really, really stupid wars, really dumb wars, would be very difficult. Now, we've already done some dumb wars. We're still in a dumb war in Afghanistan. But part of the reasons we can do that is because we have the technology and we have the size of the military. But imagine if the American public was sick of the war in Afghanistan. You know, Obama said he would end it. He didn't. Trump said he would end it. He didn't. Imagine if the American public said, oh, you know, this is crap. We're just not going to write. We're going to start shrinking the amount of money we write you every month until you stop this war. We're not going to fund the military to go fight a stupid war in Afghanistan or to fight it stupidly. You know, either win it and come home or come home. Anyway, some of the benefits of having volunteer armies and volunteer funding. All right. Of course, Trump's whole notion of funding this free rider issue through trade wars is completely bogus. And actually, the author of this op-ed illustrates that it's completely bogus. He says that it doesn't work, that the biggest loser of a trade war is the United States. We're the biggest beneficiary of trades in the world. We actually have a surplus with Canada, and we're trying to fight a war with Canada. Not that a surplus means anything, but just this idea that it's all about deficits. But we're running a surplus with Canada, so why we're fighting with them? People around Trump, unfortunately, many of them, think trade is bad. And luckily, not all of them. So there's some, I think, rational voices there that are mitigating the damage that he could do. But he's already done a lot of damage to this country over trade. So there's no free rider problem with trade. Trade is win-win. China's not free riding off of us. It's benefiting from open shipping lanes. Cool. But we're all benefiting from that. It's benefiting from the fact that we're buying their goods. But that's because we're benefiting. Otherwise, we wouldn't buy their goods. So again, it's win-win. There's no losers here. Is it disproportionate? Are they benefiting more? In a dollar sense, yes, because they started, in a percentage sense, yes, because they started so poor, every dollar you add to the economy is a huge percentage increase. But so what? Why does that matter? We're benefiting. We're better off. Now, could trade be better if all countries lower tariffs? Absolutely. Absolutely. But the way to get them there is not what Trump's doing. Because Trump's goal is not, and I've said this many times, Trump's goal is not free trade. There's no evidence other than a few statements of his. But I don't believe anything he says. So because he, you know, he changes his mind constantly. But every indication is, beyond like three times he said, oh, let's just lower tariffs and subsidies on everything. But everything else he does, everything else he says, suggest the opposite, suggest that he's anti-trade and a very, very much a protectionist. And by the way, the NAFTA deal with Mexico, this deal that he's cut, is perfect example of that. It hasn't caused them to lower tariffs and after lowest tariffs. It's just changed the composition of the cronyism of NAFTA. It just made NAFTA crony in a different way. It benefits different industries and hurts different industries. That's all. It hasn't changed the dynamics in any substantial way at all. I mean, the dynamics of tariffs, of free trade. It hasn't made Mexico lower their tariffs dramatically, or in us lower tariffs. It's made some products easier and some products harder to move between the two countries. All right, let me do a few Super Chat questions quickly before I get to the Patreon questions. This is from Logan. Thank you, Logan, for the support. I just finished Peacock's History of Philosophy course on ARI website and loved it. Will part two be put on ARI on the website? No, it won't be. And the reason is, and I need to say this cautiously, but the reason is that Leonard doesn't think part two is that good. He thinks he's good up through Kant. And that's why, if you notice, we put up part one plus the first section of part two, just, I think, through Kant. Beyond Kant, when it comes to the more modern philosophers, Leonard doesn't think his course is that good. So while we're still offering it on the bookstore, and you know, maybe it will be available one day on YouTube. It has the historical significance, importance. He did do it, but it's not going to be part of the curriculum on campus because Leonard's asked us not to include it. Leonard's very critical of his own work in the past, but he's also very objective, and he also exaggerates a lot. So but when he says it's not good, I'm sure he has good reasons why there's certain sections there which he thinks are wrong. And I think it's still hugely valuable for people. But generally, I don't think you should use the history of philosophy. If you are serious about philosophy, seriously about knowing the history of philosophy, you shouldn't use Leonard's course exclusively. You should study the philosophy from other sources as well. I think Leonard would second what I just said. And that is especially true, Leonard would say, on the second part of his history course. You can't find the second part of the history course on the Ayn Rand Institute ESTO. Okay, I got a few more. I'm going to go through these quickly, unless it's a complex question, and then I'll postpone. Okay. Do you think conspiracy theories are ever a good thing? Stay tuned, Action Jackson. I'm going to do not a whole show on conspiracy theories, but I'm doing an interview on Thursday with Ben Baer, a philosopher at the Ayn Rand Institute and a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, but a philosophy PhD. And he's coming out with a major article about conspiracy theories and Ayn Rand's attitude towards conspiracy theories. And we are going to talk about that on that show. So we're going to devote a big chunk of the show to exactly that question. The short answer is no, I don't think conspiracy theories are ever a good thing. But for more details, stay tuned. On Thursday of next week, we'll be doing that show. What is the most current movie with a good portrayal example of objectivism? Well, I don't know what you mean by that. I said, for example, what does it mean, a good portrayal example of objectivism? All you can get in a movie today are good portrayals of aspects of objectivism. You know, I mentioned the Equalizer movie I thought was an aspect of justice, of the pursuit of justice. Now, there's an issue there of vigilante justice, but he is a man of justice. The second Equalizer movie, I think, does a good job concretizing the issue of free will and the issue of you're responsible for your own moral character, you're responsible for your moral decisions. And I think it does a good job concretizing that. So all you can do in a movie, unless it was written by a genius like Ayn Rand, is concretize a particular aspect or a virtue of objectivism. You're not, you know, and at the end of the day, what movies do is, you know, like all art is a selective recreation of an artist's metaphysical value judgment. So we could talk about the metaphysical value judgments that that these movies project. Suddenly, I think, as I said, the second Equalizer movie suggests kind of a world in which you control your own destiny. That is, you control your own fate. You control your own character, more importantly. And that is very much a metaphysical value judgment about the nature of man. All right, quickly, let's see if these are quick. Can you explain what insider trading is and how it should be thought about in terms of free market? Okay, I'm going to leave that to possibly, probably tomorrow. I'm gonna do a lot of economic issues tomorrow, and let me add that to one of the topics that I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm just going to copy-paste it into the doc here to make sure I don't forget it. Okay, so I've got that. So stay tuned. Sorry about that. Why is Ayn Rand why is it that Ayn Rand approved of von Mises and Hazlitt, yet disapproved of Friedman and Hayek? Just quickly, because von Mises wouldn't compromise. He was a laissez-faire capitalist through and through, whereas Friedman believed there should be a central bank. There's a famous story about, I think it was the first or second meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society, which was a society of classical liberals. In 1947 was the first meeting. And Mises and I think Hazlitt, Friedman and Hayek were all members. And at some point, von Mises got up and he yelled at them, at basically all of them, right? And he said, "You're all a bunch of socialists." And he walked out. And a lot of the disagreement was about a central bank. So that's one example. Hayek, if you read The Road to Serfdom, it is filled with compromises, philosophical compromises, economic compromises, granting. I mean, he's talking about the slippery slope of the road to serfdom, and he is sliding away on that slippery slope. Friedman did the same thing. He kept proposing things like negative income taxes and all kinds of cute ways to, in a sense, sustain statism. So while I admire Friedman and to some extent, limited extent, Hayek, more limited extent, Hayek, I admire Friedman primarily for his brilliant, simple explanations for economic concepts live during Q&As. He was a master of it. And you could see all the videos on YouTube. I mean, I wish he was alive today to ridicule Donald Trump's trade policies. But he's not, so all you got is me. But Hayek was of the three, of the four of them, Hayek was the most compromising, and particularly in, and of course his social philosophy and his philosophical writings are terrible, are very, very opposed to everything objectivism stands for. So for all those reasons, for the primary reason, Mises and Hazlitt were uncompromising laissez-faire capitalists. They weren't objectivists. And philosophically, they were wrong, but at least in their area of expertise in economics, they did not compromise, whereas Friedman and Hayek did. So she had a huge admiration for them because of that uncompromising stand that they took. Okay, last one. Jamie Brown and I were wondering, this is Karen, where Ocon 19 will be. We sort of missed the last few. Yeah, where were you guys? We missed you too. Next one is in Cleveland. Cleveland in June, mid-June of 19. It will be in Cleveland. So, and you can look it up, Ocon 19. I think the website's up. There is a website. So please go there. In terms of sense of life, in terms of aesthetics, I'm a huge fan of Mr. Sunshine, the Korean show. So just with regard to that question about, I don't know, objectivist values, but Mr. Sunshine's beautiful. All right, we can do a whole show on aesthetics, on me making movie recommendations. We can do that. You know, we'll do that one day. And I'll pull out my list of all the movies I don't want you to think that... Anyway, there's no objectivist art other than what Ayn Rand created. There's good art there, and then there's art that reflects objectivist values. But beware of thinking of movies as objectivist movies. They're not objectivist movies. They are good movies, and they are good shows. And I'm glad some of you are enjoying Mr. Sunshine. Mr. Sunshine, maybe you discovered it yourself, or maybe you benefited from my recommendation. You free writers, you should all be making contributions on Patreon to avoid being free writers, right? And of course, subscribe to my YouTube channel. Right now, you go, subscribe, done, easy, no big deal. All right, let's get to some Patreon questions. And again, I'm going to skip some here, not because I'm going to do them tomorrow. So tomorrow, 3 p.m. East Coast time, we're going to do another show. We're also going to do one on Sunday, I think also 3 p.m. East Coast time. And we're also going to do one on Monday at 8 p.m. East Coast time. Tuesday, Wednesday, we're probably off. Maybe Tuesday, when I'm in New York. Then on Thursday, we're going to do the interview with Ben Baer, and we're going to talk conspiracy theories, and then we'll see after that. But Saturday, Sunday, Monday, maybe Tuesday, certainly Thursday. All right? That's plenty of shows for you guys to support through Patreon. All right, let's see. Dan Weishart asked a question. There's a lot to say about this. What is the source of the claim? If it is not regulated, it's not safe. How do you change it? Now, he gives an example here from flight. I guess he's a pilot and he's interested in flight, but it's almost impossible today to build safe small planes with new technology. So, for example, a new power source, electric motors for 1 to 4 person airplanes are very difficult. And this is a quote: today there are no regulations that would allow practical battery-only flights. No regulations that would allow. Why would regulations allow practical battery-only flight except for ultra lights with an empty weight, light sport, must be powered by a reciprocating engine which rules out electric and aircraft in the, you know, so the assumption is it has to be regulated, otherwise it's not safe. And I'd say that, I'm going to say there are two reasons for this. There are probably many more, but let's start with two reasons for it. One much more fundamental than the other. One is the reason that people always give. One is the reason that people hold in their mind. The other is the reason that drives it all, right? So the first reason is everybody knows of examples where bad things happened, unsafe things happened, when things were perceived to be not regulated, right? Perceived to be not regulated, or were indeed not regulated. So, I don't know, financial crisis happened because we are told lack of regulations. Whenever there's lack of regulations, we are told over and over and over and over and over again, bad things happen. Risk is too high. Things get out of whack. So you need regulations because otherwise you'll have lots of financial crisis. And look, here's the example. We got rid of Sarbanes-Oxley or part of Sarbanes-Oxley, and we got the financial crisis, causal relationship, bam, 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 here it is. And there are a million examples like that, right? There was this drug before the FDA was really serious or before the FDA was established, pregnant women took it. It caused massive birth defects. If the FDA had been around, that wouldn't have happened. See, this is what happens when you don't have regulations, right? When you don't have regulations. So, and then there are the stories from the 19th century, from the Muddruckers. What was that? I forget the name of the novel that was written about the meat. the meat plants, somebody on YouTube, on Facebook will remind me. But there's this notion of there was all this dirty meat. Now, there probably was. It was early. Hygiene was not fully understood. The benefits, the health benefit of hygiene were relatively new. There was a lot going on in terms of the industry. It was evolving. There was competition. And I completely believe that the meat industry would have cleaned itself up, and the industry would have cleaned up faster probably than happened under the FDA. But that's when the FDA was really created. It was really created as a backlash to this idea that the meat factories, the jungle is the name of the book, of course, the jungle, that the market failed. Now, I'm dubious about the stories. I'm dubious about whether the market really failed. The history is spotty, but you have to realize that it's true. In the days before regulations, because those days were early capitalism and people didn't fully understand, and because there was little capital, because productivity was so low, people took more risks on the job, so there were more accidents. People took more risks in terms of maybe cleanliness, because there wasn't the capital to be as clean as you can make it today. So yeah, life was risky back then. Life was risky. But that was part of the evolution of capitalism. Life is risky in third world countries today that are trying to develop because they're too poor to reduce risk. But the reduction of risk would have happened naturally. One of my favorite illustrations of this is a graph I've seen of OSHA. That's the Occupation and Hazard law that passed, which regulates workplace safety. And what you always see is that people show you the graph and it goes from the date when OSHA passed, it goes down. That is, workplace safety increases. It gets better. The number of accidents, deaths, injuries, in every respect goes down. And they say, see, we passed the regulation and things got better. Regulations are good. But what they don't show you and what people don't ask about and what is never discussed is what does the graph look like before the regulation was passed? And what the graph looks like before the regulation passed is steady decrease in fatalities and injuries and workplace accidents. So the problem was being solved by the market. A regulation was introduced, and there's no evidence to suggest it accelerated. The graph doesn't get steeper. Indeed, it gets a little less steep. I think because the regulations give people an excuse, a reason, not to maximize safety. There was a good example of this. You remember the BP oil spill in the Gulf. And it turned out that BP had done something to that unit that failed, the thing that failed. They had basically maintained it to the standards set by regulation. And that was it. No better. If you look at Exxon and some of the other oil companies, basically in the same area of the Gulf, they exceeded the regulatory requirements. They were safer than regulation demanded. Why? Because it made good business sense. BP decided not to. Bad business decision. But it was allowed to do that. It could get away with that. Investors didn't look into it. They didn't care. It hasn't been penalized fully for it because it met the regulatory standard. So regulations actually make things potentially worse. And of course, they exclude innovation. They exclude the cost of regulation is unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's impossible to measure in terms of the damage that it does. But the stories people are told over and over and over again, the concretes that they get, the history that they are taught, all suggest to them, I think, legitimately, that is, you would have to really think outside of the box. You would have to really do your own research. You would have to really encounter other thinkers, like Ayn Rand, like this podcast, to discover that that history maybe is tainted and maybe is wrong, and maybe there's different explanations for the phenomenon. they get told over and over again that it is a fact, and with concrete. So it's not a floating abstraction. They've got lots of concrete. So it makes it very, very difficult to fight, because you have to challenge every one of those concretes. Now, this is the challenge, though. This is the issue, though, that it's not just that, right? We could challenge every concrete, and we have. There's an explanation for, I mean, every one of these be challenged. The jungle is being challenged. Certainly the financial crisis, I challenged it. The FDA, the value of the FDA, the contribution of the FDA, all of that has been challenged over and over and over again historically. Now, it's not dominant, but then they have to ask the question, why? Why is one theory view of history dominant? Well, the other is not. Why is one view of regulation dominant? Why are all the concretes aligned just with one view and the other view doesn't get a hearing? And here is the deeper cause. Why, if it's not regulated, it's not safe? And the deeper cause is altruism. The deeper cause is altruism. And you say, altruism? How's altruism? What's altruism got to do with this? What's altruism got to do with regulation? What's altruism got to do with people's attitudes towards regulations? So let's step back a little bit. Let's step back a second. And now, altruism, as you know, as many of you know anyway, but for the sake of those who are relatively new, altruism is the moral ideal that you should live for other people, that other people's lives are what is important, what your entire moral focus should be. A direct implication, an explicit implication of altruism is that self-interest is bad. And the way in which the altruists explain this to people is that they associate with self-interest everything imaginable bad in the world. People who are self-interested are lying, cheating, stealing, SOBs. They will walk on corpses. They will do everything. They create a package deal. Yes, Steve Jobs is self-interested, but so is Bernie Madoff. It's all one package. Lying, producing, pursuing happiness, and lying, stealing, cheating. I mean, everybody holds this. Everybody holds this in their minds. When you say self-interest, that's what pops into people's minds. Because the altruists have planted it there. The moral theory of altruism sets up this dichotomy. There are only two possibilities. You either live for other people in one way or another, to what some extent or another, right? Depending on the type of idealism, right? And what living for other people means might vary from philosopher to philosopher, right? Or you're a lying, stealing, cheating SOB. You can't be ethical. There's no ethics outside of altruism. Everything outside of altruism is amoral or immoral. So, what is business? Everybody knows. Everybody can see. Everybody knows, again, implicitly. If you ask people, what motivates a businessman? What motivates an entrepreneur? Well, I mean, they'll think about it a little bit, and they'll be a little bit embarrassed to say it, particularly in a business school. But at some point, somebody will say, making money. Yeah. For whom? For themselves. So a businessman self-interested? Yeah, definitely. So self-interested. All right. Now you put businessman into this package, into this folder, this file folder in your mind that has lying, cheating, stealing in it. It has corruption built into it. Cutting corners. Placing profits above people. Right? Creating that dichotomy. Doing anything for a buck. Anything. Including causing birth defects in mothers who, you know, just so you can make money off your drug. Altruism makes us think that way because that's the only two options that exist. If you're a businessman, you have to be bad in some way. I mean, look at the movies about businessmen. They're all like this. in one way or another. The businessman is always bad in the movie. And it could be bad in his business behavior. It could be bad in the way he treats his wife and kids. In some way, the businessman is corrupt because being self-interested is corrupt and corrupting. So how can we leave the market free for people who are corrupt and corrupting? How can we have a bunch of lying, stealing, cheating individuals out there in the marketplace trading without regulations, without controls? Well, we can't. We have to control them. We have to place those controls in the hands of people, the saints, the bureaucrats, right? The saints who have the altruistic interests of the people, the common interest, the public good. They need to monitor and make sure to control the animal spirits, to control the self-interested spirit of the businessman. Yeah, some self-interest is good, the conservatives will tell you. Conservatives are good at this, right? Conservatives will tell you some self-interest is good because it gets the juices going and people produce, but not too much. Not too much. That's why we need some regulation, they say. We need to control the animal spirits. We need to control the original sin. We need to control the evil behavior through regulation. And without it, everything falls apart because the bad guys, the selfish bastards, take over. And everything, and the markets fail. Markets fail, right? In that they hurt people. So it's at the core altruism. Now you can go deeper and you can say, it's a fundamental, their fundamental view of man, and it's a negation of reason. It's a negation of reason as man's basic means of survival. And people are too stupid to know what's good for them. People are not rational enough to know. You need a rational central planner to be able to approve which goods you shouldn't be able to give to your kids, because otherwise you'll feed them poison. You can't take care of them, not because you don't want to, even if you're a good person, because you cannot, because you don't have the capacity. This goes back to Plato. We're all in a cave. We don't see the truth. We're incapable of knowing reality. We're incapable of knowing what's good for us. Even if pursuing our self-interest was a good thing, we're just incapable of it. So regulation is a direct consequence of deep philosophical ideas, metaphysical ideas about the nature of man. Do we have the capacity to make rational decisions about the world, about our lives, about what's good for us and what's bad for us? Can we make choices? I don't even know how to address this if you have no free will, because if you have no free will, I don't understand what the regulators are doing. Anyway, the whole thing, I think everything, the world falls apart if you don't have free will. But if you don't have the capacity, then, free marketers say, the conservative free marketers will say, oh, well, to some extent, the markets work. The markets take care of it. Well, really, nobody believes that. Nobody believes that a bunch of irrational traders, ultimately, the result is going to be rational. And again, this is why conservatives cannot defend capitalism. They cannot, will not, will never be advocates for capitalism. And every step forward they take towards capitalism, they take two steps back, because their fundamental metaphysical and ethical beliefs are counter to capitalism, are the rejection of freedom and capitalism. Because they reject reason as man's basic means of survival and as something accessible to every human being by his nature, and because they reject self-interest. And they reject self-interest as low as and as necessarily leading to bad actions, to corruption. So we have regulations because we have bad philosophy, because the best defenders of free markets are conservatives or libertarians, who are also, some of whom are subjectivists, mystics, and do not believe in reason. And conservatives, who are certainly mystics and don't believe in self-interest. So it's impossible So you ask, how do you change it? By changing the philosophy. There are no shortcuts. This is why I always say it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a long time. And why you would think that somebody could come along today and change things in any substantial way, I have no idea. These ideas are deeply ingrained in people. These ideas are part of the milk they drink when they're babies. I mean, it's in everything. And to change a culture takes... To uproot these kind of ideas takes generations. And it's going to take generations. This takes generations to get to the kind of world where we will not have regulations. And it's all philosophy. It's philosophy, philosophy, philosophy. It's this view of man, the role of reason, and it's self-interest versus altruism. That's it. And once you take care of that, the history takes care of itself, because you could explain the history. And this is why you cannot win on economic arguments. This is why the libertarians are doomed to fail. This is why conservatives are doomed to fail. And the world needs objectivism. The world needs a comprehensive philosophy that answers the fundamental questions about morality, about epistemology, about the nature of man, that actually give you the answers to the questions that pop into every honest person's mind regarding regulation. But even if you're honest, but you have remnants of altruism, or if you're honest and you have remnants of mysticism, this is why you will never have a laissez-faire capitalist country that's Christian. You just won't have it. As long as religion has, particularly the Christian religion, has a strong influence on the people within a country, you cannot have laissez-faire capitalism. Because as long as this is the argument for depravity that Ayn Rand talks about, because they believe in human depravity. They believe in original sin. They believe that we won't do the right thing. And that we're incapable of doing the right thing. They believe in mysticism. Sorry, guys. There are no shortcuts. No shortcuts. This is why all this discussion about politics is so premature and silly. The idea that we would have a president today who would move us towards laissez-faire capitalism is so absurd. Yeah, they're going to do a little bit good and a little bit bad, and some presidents do more good than more bad. But the idea that we would have a president today that moved us clearly in the direction of freedom is bizarre. It is bizarre. Ken asks, I'm just going to answer this because it's entertaining. Ken asks, the Iran Islam would be better for capitalism. No, of course not. No mystical religion is better for capitalism. And Islam is collectivistic. It's anti-individualistic, which is required for capitalism. But let me say this at the same time. Islam is much more hospitable to trade, much more pro-trade and pro-wealth than Christianity is in its original documents. Muhammad was a rich trader. Jesus was a poor beggar, basically, right? Christianity is a religion of the meek and the poor and the disenfranchised. That's its founding. Islam, and the reason what makes it so dangerous, is Islam is a religion of success, of prosperity, of wealth, of military conquest. I mean, Muhammad was all of those. So in the Quran, you have a much more positive attitude towards trade than you would have in the New Testament. Much more positive. No, not loot. They were traders. The early Muslims were traders. Muhammad was a merchant. He made his money primarily through trade. Later on, he went through conquest. But even the conquest cost money. And they had money. They didn't have money because they stole it. They had money because they were traders on the Silk Roads. Roots in those days, they were traders between the East and the Byzantine Empire and Europe, and you know, that's you know, you can't deny history. That's who they were. They were Arab nomads who were traders, and they had a respect for wealth. That respect, you know, just take the attitude towards sex. Now, the attitude towards women, Islam is much worse, but that's because it has a positive attitude towards male sex. You know, positive in quotes. They believe in, have a lot of sex. Christianity has this, you know, very negative view of sex from the beginning, right? Now, again, I know, I'm already seeing it on the thing. There's nothing good about Islam, right? but in terms of in terms of economics, there is no worse religion than Christianity. In terms of pure economics, there's no worse religion than Christianity. And Islam, in terms of modern, the where Islam is today versus Christianity and Judaism, Islam is the most primitive, barbaric of all of them. But, you know, capitalism cannot thrive under any religion. Under any religion. Jesus didn't have a girlfriend. Somebody says Jesus' girlfriend was a hooker. He didn't have a girlfriend. He never had sex. At least not described in the New Testament. I mean, that's one of the differences between Judaism and Christianity's King. You know, in Judaism, you know, they have lots of sex. The attitude towards sex in Judaism is a lot healthier than the attitude towards sex in Christianity. All right, enough of that. Enough of that. Let's see. I'm going to take one more question. And okay, so I'm going to do this one. It's short. Morgan asks a question I don't know the answer to, or I don't have a well-educated, thorough answer to. Right? What do you think of those called the great American writers? Twain, Melville, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, etc. So first, all the caveats. I am not a literary expert. I am not well-read in the great literary stories. I am not, I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert. I'll channel a little bit of what I've read Ayn Rand say about this and what Leonard Peikoff has said about this. They're the experts. They were both well-read, and they thought about literature, and they had views about literature. I don't. They're all, if you will, second-handed views, because I have never given it the kind of thought that I need. I know what I like and I know what I don't like. I like Mark Twain. I don't like the others particularly. They're all pretty naturalist in the sense that they describe life as it is versus as it should and could be. They are non-romantics. But they're all good writers. They're all good writers. That they're all... they all write well, and many of their stories are interesting, but they're second class just because they're naturalists to the truly great authors like Dostoevsky and particularly Hugo. And even among naturalists, I'm not sure they match up with like Tolstoy in terms of the grandeur of what they write, in terms of the interest, although Ayn Rand thought Tolstoy was incredibly boring. So I think they're good writers, but I don't think America had, unfortunately, a great romantic artist, a great romantic writer. America had some romantic writers in the 19th century, early 20th century. You know, the one who wrote those series of books about successful entrepreneurs who start out really poor, and what's his name? Somebody on the chat will remind me of his name. And beautiful stories about success in America and about growing out of poverty and you know, taking responsibility for your own life and being successful as a consequence and the challenges that come from that. Yeah, Alger, Horatio Alger. You know, the books are certainly romantic. Are they great literature? Probably not, but they're good, particularly for young people. Horatio Alger, yeah. And I'm sure there are other romantic, American romantic authors, but these are very naturalistic. So I think they're worth reading, particularly as compared to people who follow them, who come later. But they're not inspiring. I mean, Hemingway or Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and I haven't read, I don't think I've read Hemingway or Fitzgerald since high school, are so depressing. I mean, it's so uninteresting in the end of the day. I don't know. I don't like them, but I take it from people who know literature that they're good writers. I enjoy Twain. I've enjoyed Twain. Okay, Boaz. I mean, come on, people. Stop asking me about Trump. I've said everything I've got to say about Trump. And it bores the hell out of me, and I think it bores the hell out of at least half the audience. All right, but here goes. The super chat question. Trump is reducing regulation, helping corporates, lowering taxes, trying to get fair trade, zero tariffs offsite. So why are you against him? Okay, start with the last one. I don't believe he's trying to get fair trade. Oh, my God. There is no such thing as fair trade. Fair trade is a Bernie Sanders term. It's a term that says that not only are tariffs equal between countries, but then all the environmental regulations and all the labor regulations and all the conditions under which people earn, all of that must be equal. That's fair trade. That's fair trade. And that's, by the way, what Trump wants. He wants to make it very difficult for China to export to the United States because he wants their wages to go up, environmental regulations to be there, and if they're not going to do that, then we're not going to trade with China. No, that is economic ignoramuses. That is about social planning. I get angry because I've said this so many frigging times. And this is basic economics. This is, you know, I'm not going to repeat it. I've done whole shows on this. I'll just give you the highlights. The only rational trade policy from an economic and moral perspective is to lower tariffs to zero now, immediately, unilaterally. It would be great if every country did it. But the only responsibility the American government has is for the tariffs placed on American citizens. By increasing tariffs, you're increasing taxes. It is never, ever, ever right to increase taxes. It is never moral to increase taxes. It is never strategic to increase taxes. Never, ever, ever increase taxes. I mean, that's, I don't know, coercion 101. Objectivism, economics 101. You don't increase taxes. So tariffs are taxes. The only, I'll repeat this one more time. We can do an econ class. But just open any econ book. This is something that economists actually agree on. Left, right, middle, libertarian, objectivist, everybody agrees on this. Except like two economists who happen to work at the White House. And a bunch of cronies who will do whatever Trump says. But this is complete economic ignorance. Now, the only rational, moral, an economically sound trade policy is zero tariffs on all goods except goods that are stolen. They should be banned. There shouldn't be a tariff on them. They should be banned. So if China's stealing intellectual property rights, ban those products. Don't put tariffs on it. Don't tax me because China's doing something wrong. Don't allow me to buy stolen goods. That's what governments do. That's what police do. Right? Second, there's zero evidence except, and I said this in the beginning of the show, zero evidence except three statements by Trump that he believes in zero tariffs. Now, Trump says everything. He said a million different things about trade. Why do you believe those three statements and not the other 100 statements where he believes in protectionism? All the evidence suggests, except for those three statements, which I think are random. I think, what's his name? His economic advisor whispered in his ear, the guy from CNBC, the economist, Larry Kudlow whispered it in his ear. So for a moment he said it, but he doesn't believe it. Nothing he does suggests he believes it. The deal with Mexico is not a free trade deal. It actually increases the costs. It hasn't caused Mexico to lower tariffs. It's one of the most crony deals in history. It's taking NAFTA, which was cronyism, better than the alternative, but still cronyism. And it's still cronyism. It favors some industries at the expense of other industries. It sets all sorts of rules on what stuff can cross the border and what can't, what tariffs go up, what tariffs go down. It's changed the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. It hasn't saved the Titanic. It hasn't brought about free trade. So no, he doesn't believe in zero tariffs on all sides. When the European Commissioner offered zero trades on auto, Trump said no. And you know what he said also? Europeans don't buy enough American cars to make it work. Because his primitive, ignorant view of economics is that the way trade should work, fair trade, is that Europeans buy exactly the same number of cars from Americans as Americans buy from Europeans. Now that is so dumb. That is so stupid. But that's what he said in this interview, basically what he implied in this interview. There is zero reason to believe he understands trade and he wants zero tariffs on all sides. So please never ask me that again, because it's just a misrepresentation of what Trump is saying. And he purposefully confuses. He knows what he's doing. He says a little bit to appease everybody, to create confusion, because he's a great marketer and he knows that when people are confused, his charisma can get it through. He's a demagogue, and it's exactly what demagogues do. He lowered corporate taxes. I'm all for lowering corporate taxes. Indeed, most Democrats are for lowering corporate taxes. There was unanimity in the country around lowering corporate taxes even before Trump. There was talk under Obama about lowering corporate taxes, but he couldn't cut a deal with Republicans because he wanted to also, I don't know, increase other taxes. And Republicans didn't want to work with Obama. But if you cut taxes, corporate taxes, great, good, win, wonderful, right? But on the personal taxes, nothing was done. A little bit lowering. The only tax that really matters from an economics perspective is the top marginal income tax rate, also from a moral perspective. The rich should pay less taxes. That was reduced by a fraction. And it doesn't matter, because government spending is higher than it was under Obama. So you've lowered taxes, but you're spending more. Where does the difference come from? You're borrowing more. The Treasury has done some of the largest auctions ever since the stimulus package, Obama's stimulus package, which I assume you're all against, because it was Obama, not because I think you understand why stimulus doesn't work. Sorry if I'm insulting my audience. I know, I get carried away. I don't mean all of you don't know why a stimulus doesn't work, but some of you don't. Some of you objected to everything Obama did because it was Obama, and some of you approve of everything Donald Trump does because it's Trump. So we're spending a lot of money, and we're borrowing like crazy. So we lower taxes. It makes no, or very little, excuse me, economic difference or moral difference. Because if you borrow, it means you're going to have to tax in the future to pay the debt back. So while you lower taxes today, you're increasing taxes in the future. Now, how is that right? How is giving a break to people today and taxing future generations right? But it's also wrong, because spending today sucks money out of the private economy through the issuance of bonds, which is not invested into productive activity. So cutting taxes is good, but not that good. I never argued that cutting taxes is important, because it's not. What's important is cutting spending. And Republicans won't cut spending. And until they cut spending, they will get hell from me. Right? I will attack them. So kingdom come, because the only thing that matters is cutting spending. Now Trump is reducing regulations. That's true, and I've praised him many times for reducing regulations. I think he's doing it by accident. I don't think he cares one way or the other. He hasn't pushed Congress to pass legislation that reduces regulations, which would have long-term impact and long-term effect, because it's very difficult to overturn legislation. He's hired some good people to the regulatory agencies, and they are through administrative powers reducing regulations. Those administrative powers could be used like that to reverse everything that they're doing. But why isn't Donald Trump out there? Instead of everything that he is doing, why isn't he tweeting that the Republican Congress should pass massive deregulation? That would make a difference. That would make a huge difference. And would be sustaining. And it would change the entire business environment, not just for his administration, but for years and decades potentially to come. That's what Jimmy Carter did. I know, but if you go back and look at Jimmy Carter, he massively deregulated through legislation. And so did Ronald Reagan. So the regulatory agencies are deregulating. I'm all for that. I think that's wonderful. I think that's good. But why aren't we doing what is necessary? You've got a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a nominally Republican president. Why isn't it happening? What are the excuses? Where's the leadership? Donald Trump is this master leader. He's this great leader. Why isn't he rallying the country around cutting spending and cutting regulations? And let me add, at the Treasury Department, who is in charge of financial regulation, I don't see the deregulation. I see Freddie and Fannie, bigger than they've ever been. And a Treasury Department that is supporting their continued existence 10 years after the financial crisis. The idea, 10 years ago, if you had told me that Freddie and Fannie would still exist, I would have said, you're nuts. 10 years ago, if you had said Freddie and Fannie would still exist in spite of having a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president, I would have said, you're completely insane. But there they are. And the Treasury Department wants to continue their existence. They have supported bills in Congress to continue their existence. Dodd-Frank is supposed to be reformed, supposed to be done away with. All this too big to fail stuff. Nothing. Nothing. Leadership. So the real big regulations, Obamacare. Right? Yeah, he's chipping away at their fringes. No, it's good. I'm all for chipping away at the edges, whatever it takes. But to praise him for it, to make a big deal out of it, is ridiculous. If they'd done away with Obamacare, wow. If they'd done away with Dodd-Frank or big chunks of Dodd-Frank, wow. If they passed one law that significantly deregulated an industry, wow. But they haven't. They've chipped away at the regulatory agencies, at little details. And yet, again, I'm all for that. But let's not delude ourselves. So many of you are deluding yourselves that makes such a big difference. It short run, but not in the long run. Not in the long run, not in the medium run. It just ain't going to happen. So that's why I'm against it. And now, that's not why I'm against it, right? That's some of the details of why am I against him. I'm against him for a thousand other reasons. I'm against him because he's making the presidency of the United States. He's demeaning the very nature of the presidency of the United States. I'm against him because he's institutionalizing an authoritarian mentality in people. People accepting an authoritarian view of the world because of him. And he is, in his nature, an authoritarian. He's not acting like an authoritarian because he can't. But his nature is authoritarian. I dislike him as president because he's vulgar and he's nasty and he's stupid and he's backstabbing his own people. He has no loyalty. He undermines the rule of law. He undermines the very nature of our government. He despises the division of power and the separation of powers that our beautiful Constitution allowed for. I can't think of all the different ways in which I think he's a bad president. Yeah, he deregulates some. Good for him. Good for us. Good for us. And lower corporate taxes is good. It's good. It's good. There's nothing bad about that. But the idea that that redeems everything else, or that those are good of such magnitude that we should be celebrating, I think is delusional. All right, I didn't want to do that, but somebody paid for me to do that. So, you know, when you pay me, I do it. We're going to cut it here. I've got a bunch of other questions, some interesting stuff on economics that we're going to do tomorrow on Bamul's cost disease, which is an interesting idea. We're going to talk about cryptocurrencies tomorrow. Oh, your favorite topic, cryptocurrencies, some of your favorite topics. I definitely want to devote a segment either tomorrow or Sunday. Maybe we'll do this Sunday to Me Too, to the Me Too movement. And what it means and what it means for romance and all of that. And we'll see what else we get to. But certainly, you know, certainly we'll cover those topics. Then we've got a few. We've got insider trading, and we've got a couple of other questions from last time that I haven't got to. So tomorrow's going to be an interesting show. Tomorrow will be an interesting show. And so that'll be at 3 p.m. East Coast time tomorrow, same on Sunday. And what else can I tell you? Well, obviously, subscribe to my YouTube channel. Let your friends know about my YouTube channel. Encourage them to subscribe to my YouTube channel. There we go. Greg Salimieri, I didn't see this note. Hawthorne is a higher romantic. That's right. Hawthorne is fantastic. If you want an American romantic, then Hawthorne is a, you know, a Horatiologist is more for teenagers. Hawthorne's for adults and for teenagers. But Ayn Rand had a lot of positive things to say about the Scarlet Letter. I think it's in the Romantic Manifesto. So thank you, Greg, for that. And any other, if any of you, I haven't read that section of the Romantic Manifesto in a while, but if anybody else has some ideas about good romantic literature, American romantic literature, you know, let me know. Send me a note. Put it up on the chat. Let other people know. Or just literature that you enjoy. That's always a value. Just be careful about calling something great without doing the aesthetic analysis to determine whether it's great. Just because you like it doesn't mean it's great. All right. Subscribe and support me on Patreon. All right, we're at a good number at Patreon. We're upgrading the equipment. We're going to do more shows. I have to let you know about this event in London, exciting event with Douglas Murray. Douglas Murray, who wrote this book about the death of Europe, about Islam, about the impact migrants are having and European culture, are having on European culture and are having on Europe, and it predicts the death of Europe, and we're going to have a conversation. I don't think it's a debate. I think we'll agree on some things. I think we'll disagree on some things. I think it's actually going to be really interesting because he's a good thinker, and he's an intellectual, and you know, for me, it's fantastic to be on stage with somebody like that. He's you know, a huge best-selling author, and we're gonna tape it. We're going to hopefully live stream it. You in the States will be able to watch it. But come watch it live. I think half the tickets are already sold. It's £20, 10 for students. So sign up. Come do it. Come attend. Ask live questions. And Claire, I hate it when names don't come to me. Anyway, Claire, who I like a lot. She's wonderful. I've known her. She runs an event called Battle of Ideas in London, and I participated a couple of times. And she's been very friendly to me and to the Institute. I'd say old classical liberal, leans left, I think, but pro free speech. You know, good person. She's gonna be the I don't know, the moderator of the panel, of the discussion. So it's going to be really good. I'm really looking forward to it. And I think you guys getting to know Douglas Murray is really good. And watching our interaction will be good. And for those of you obsessed about Islam, you know, you're going to get somebody to debate me finally. But he's a good guy. All right. I hope you watch. Yeah, he's been on all over the media. Has been on Fox. He's a big shot. So please, please, Claire Fox, Claire Fox. So please show up. Let's have a standing room only event. Let's blow the ceiling off of this thing. Please watch on live stream. By the way, my events in Brazil were watched on live stream by over 100,000 people. And the audiences in the two of the events had audiences of over or close to 1,000. One just under 1,000, one just over 1,000. So this should be good. When is the discussion with Douglas Murray? It is the 21st. It's Friday. It's a Friday. It's a Friday in September in 2 weeks, right? I think it's the 21st. Yes. If today is the 7th, then it would be the 21st at, I think, 7:30 p.m. in Westminster. So very central. Come in by train. It's not going to be like what we did with Salgo Navacard, where they're going to kick people out. This is not at a university. It's our facility. We've paid for it. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. Come and join us. All right. See you all tomorrow. Let's see. I need to press the button to stop all of this. Have fun, guys. Have a great weekend. Bye. Interesting.